We're at Splash 2011 with the great David Unger. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
My pleasure, Chuck.
Excellent. So before we get into your excellent keynote, if you will, for Onward, that session on everything you know about concurrency is wrong,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the history with self,
mm-hmm.
starting there. So what were some of your, what was the vision of self?
What I've been interested in all along is helping bridge the gap between the way people think and what we have to think about in order to program computers. Mm. And I'd known APL, which was my first language, and Smalltalk. And then Randy Smith and I got together to design a language that would be like Smalltalk, but better and more like Smalltalk than Smalltalk. What we did was we started removing features.
Okay.
And I was partly inspired by a lunchtime conversation with Peter Deutsch, who had been a mentor for me early in my career, wonderful, brilliant person. And Randy, who has just a great original take on many, many things. And what we discovered is that as we removed features, the language kept getting more and more powerful.
Mm.
So that was a great surprise.
Interesting.
What happened was Randy went off to pursue other interests, and at Stanford, my students and I looked at implementation technology.
Mm.
And we developed some clever ideas around the difference between what's observable and what actually happens, and used those to pioneer techniques like adaptive optimization and dynamic de-optimization.
Mm.
Key students there would be Craig Chambers and Urs Hutzle.
Okay.
And Lars Bach did some work on that. He's here at the conference.
Yeah, he was saying he was your student, right?
No,
he
Lars
worked, with you.
Worked for us at Sun. The project later moved to Sun Microsystems.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, when a startup Lars and Urs had been involved in, which took our virtual machine ideas and adapted them to Java.
Mm.
When that was acquired by Sun, some years after Sun canceled the Self project, I went and worked for Lars to actually help make that a success. And that turned into Hotspot.
Interesting.
So whenever anyone basically uses a Java virtual machine, they're benefiting from the optimization ideas that my students and employees and I, an employer in the case of Lars and his team, worked on.
In self,
that's
excellent.
Right.
That's and of right. course, JavaScript benefits from the prototype object orientation.
Yes,
self,
the
right?
prototype model, which I think is simpler and a better match to the way people think. And I'm inspired there after the fact by work done by Lakoff and Rausch in a book called Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things,
okay.
where they actually did experiments on how people think.
Huh.
So I believe the prototype model has fewer fundamental concepts, fits people's minds better, and is just a more effective way for people to deal with objects than a class-based model. So that's another mark. And the other interesting thing that happened in the project was the application of cartoon animation to user interfaces.
Yes.
And that was a lot of fun. I had a small son. I had a VCR with Great Job Shuttle. And got interested in animation along with Randy Smith and Chuck Clanton, who was consulting at Sun at the time. And he was an expert on the human visual system.
Mm.
So we figured out how the cartoon animation techniques could be applied to computer interfaces, and my grad student at the time, Bei-Wei Chang, did a lot of that work to make things much more legible when things move across the screen. And today, whether because folks read that paper or not, you see those principles applied.
Absolutely.
All the time. So those three things are probably my main contribution. Those three papers each got lasting impact awards from 10 to 23 years after publication.
Absolutely. And you were recently added as an ACM fellow, I believe, in 2010?
Yes.
Excellent.
And I was honored to receive the Dal Nygaard or Nugo Award in 2009, a sort of a lifetime contribution to object-oriented technology by ACOOP.
Excellent, excellent. Well deserved.
Thank you.
So let's jump into 2011 and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Your talk was very, very interesting because essentially you were talking about the problem of concurrent and parallel programming in general is a problem that has not been solved and that our current tools pretty much can't solve them. At least that was the way that I interpreted the talk, in the sense that the way that we think about solving them today probably isn't the best way. And I wanted to talk to you more about two aspects of that, the software side and also the hardware side,
mm-hmm.
because we're going to have to work together to solve this problem. Can you give people a sort of synopsis? It's probably better than mine.
Sure. Well, for the past almost 5 years now, I've been privileged to work at IBM Research. And we have a project there where we are looking into the future of architecture. And one good bet is that we will see chips that are inexpensive with lots of cores, hundreds of cores, thousands of cores on each chip. And that's because of the way the physics of the circuits are going, where it's hard to increase the clock speed, but they can still put a lot more devices on a chip. Mm. And replicating a core many, many times is efficient design-wise and a good use of the technology. And if that happens, how will you program them? It's not the same problem as programming what we call a multi-core chip today, which has 2, 4, 8, 16 cores. We think when you get to 1,000, it's a whole different ballgame. And furthermore, at IBM, we have clients who use our applications who would love to be able to scale up. As the hardware provides more parallelism, it would be very valuable to them to be able to exploit that and run applications with bigger data and get greater throughput. So it's a pertinent problem to the business. It's a great research problem. It's a perfect thing for us to work on. And we have the privilege of looking at solutions which are non-orthodox.
Excellent.
Now, there's something called Amdahl's Law, which is well known to computer scientists. And it states that if you have a problem that's, say, 90% parallelizable, but 10% has to be serial, you're never going to get it to go faster than that 10%, no matter how much you parallelize it. Mm. And what that means is as long as you have a serial portion, your scaling is going to be limited. So following that to its logical conclusion, it looks like we want to aim to eliminate that serial portion altogether, if at all possible.
Hmm.
Now, one thing that's inherently serial that people rely on a lot today is synchronization. To get things to happen in the right order, they make some things wait for other things, or in some cases they use atomic instructions like compare and swap, or what are called larks and sticks on a power architecture. And we're not sure that kind of solution will scale into the future. So if you do abandon synchronization, then you have to deal with results that may not be exactly perfect all the time. So instead, you move into a realm where you're looking at getting results that are good enough soon enough.
Okay.
And we think that such systems can provide tremendous value to the people who use them. A lot of times the data are approximate anyway. A lot of times there is no one exact correct answer. And a lot of times if you had to make it perfect, you couldn't scale it, you couldn't get the answer in time that you need. So my talk was, let's look at this. What happens then? And there's a fundamental trade-off between correctness and performance. So everywhere you look, we tend to add delay to make things come out correct. For example, we only turn the clock speed up so far on our processors because they become unreliable when they go faster. Or our digital arbiter has to have a certain amount of delay built in to arbitrate between two asynchronous signals reliably enough. And in my talk, I used Romeo and Juliet as an example.
Yes.
But I won't go into that right now.
That was an excellent talk, by the way.
Thank you, Chuck.
That was an excellent metaphor.
But the bottom line is, if only Romeo had inserted a little bit of delay between hearing about Juliet's death and killing himself, he might have heard that Juliet's death was a fake.
Yes.
And there would have been a whole happy ending.
Absolutely.
So, I reported on some particular work I did with an application and a data structure. The application was a super duper spreadsheet. And there you have a conflict between updating caches and invalidating them. It's usually solved by some kind of lock. And we showed that if you don't have the lock, you can take some of your extra cores or threads and let them freshen caches that appear to be good anyway. And by using that technique, you can mitigate the staleness of the data in the caches that you would get by trying to work without these locks. Because whenever you have no synchronization, you have the possibility of race conditions. And the other part of the talk dealt with a particular data structure. It was a hash table with chaining.
Okay.
And what was interesting was that without locks and with concurrent execution, there are two classes of errors: missed insertions and duplicate insertions. With a very simple change to the code, we could eliminate the possibility of duplicate insertions. And then, in both situations, I talked about mitigation strategies. So there are ways to have threads drop breadcrumbs, as we like to call them, or intention locks. And reduce the windows of vulnerability so you can decrease the frequency of stale data. So this whole area of looking at data structures or application algorithms in which we allow for imperfection in the results, but then go back and mitigate them, seems to me to be a bit of a new area. That is, I'm not familiar with a lot of work being done there. Martin Reinhard has done some, professor at MIT. And in particular, the data structure area seems like a whole new interesting field that may be opening up. However, I wouldn't be surprised if someone at this conference walks up to me and says, well, you know the work of thus and such. They've been working on this already. And that would be great.
Excellent.
So, spreading the knowledge, spreading the importance. I think that in the future, this whole area will become more important. And certainly by working on it at IBM Research, we hope to be able to build systems that serve our clients even better.
Excellent. So one of the questions that I had after your talk as well was, we talk a lot about this future of 1,000 cores on a chip running on my PC, for example. One of the questions I have is, what sort of application would really take advantage of that much computing capability? When you think about what we do on our desktop, we need to start thinking about, yes, you can program, let's say that yes, you can program these chips in your model, and a lot of research is done, but what are you going to make?
Well, imagine the largest Fortune 500 business you can think of,
okay,
putting every detail of every transaction into the system, and being able to query it, to roll it up by geography or by time interval, being able to do future what-if scenarios. So business analytics are one tremendous area that
Certainly.
We see as providing great value. Then there's the whole notion of a smarter planet, you know, gathering more and more data, traffic patterns in a city, just about anything you can think of that needs a lot of data is one whole area. We've seen on our personal computers an inexorable appetite for more and more sophisticated things. Natural language understanding.
Got it.
IBM's Watson is another wonderful thing where it understands these Jeopardy questions and gives answers. And that's probably an application that can use as much processing as we can think to throw at it.
Absolutely. I mean, that would make sense. I mean, you could think of, in some sense, your PCs and portable computers become smarter because they're able to compute intelligence, which is going to require thousands of cores.
Yes.
And lots of memory.
Yes. Associative search is another one.
Okay.
Finding things on your PC by how you think of it instead of how the computer thinks of it.
Interesting. Very interesting. So what are, in your opinion, what's the biggest problem in computer science today, or in the world of general purpose computing? Like, what do you think? Is it concurrency? Is it parallelism? Is it security? What is it?
Well, I will answer not the biggest, but the one that matters most to me.
Perfect.
I care about creativity. I love that people can create amazing things. Whether it's music, poetry, bridges, buildings, programs, whatever it is, different ones will excite different people. Even a business, creating a business is an act of creativity. Finding a way to take existing things and putting them together to provide value to people. And for me, the biggest problem is what it has always been, which is building our systems in a way that help unleash creativity in people instead of hinder it.
Yes.
Every time you have to type in a password in a particular order, some amount of your creativity is being drained away and used instead to remember that thing and get it exactly right. Every time you have to do things in a particular order, every time the computer forces you to do it its way instead of yours.
Yes.
And so that, for me, has been the most interesting thread throughout my whole career. Self was a language that was designed to help unleash people's creativity. Better user interfaces unleash creativity. Fast execution of high-level languages help with creativity. Even this new idea of concurrency, where we're not going to force people to try to get it exactly right and still go fast on 1,000 cores.
Yes.
Just maybe not possible anyway. By thinking about things in this different way, harnessing emergence, we hope to unleash creativity there.
Excellent. Well, that's wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about Splash. I mean, this is the second year that it's been called this, correct? And it's now, it contains Oopsla and Plop and Onward and Wavefront. Mm-hmm. What's your take on this event?
Well, I love it. Yeah. There are a lot of wonderful people here and a lot of folks I've known through the years. Mm-hmm. And to use Brian Foote's line, it's sort of a mobile intellectual brigadoon.
Excellent. And so, the last question I'll ask is, in terms of what you're going to be spending your next few years on, it's this concurrency problem, or what else are you working on?
Right now, I am really excited by what feels to me like this whole new subfield in our area. And that is harnessing emergence, data structures that we can use without synchronization, getting these applications to scale much larger.
Yes.
I really don't see anything else on my technical horizon at this point. Mm. My talk was about some results I just got a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And I am jazzed and excited and thrilled to be working in an organization that has a tradition of being able to look into the future and investing in it and letting creative people, and I think I'm one of them.
Of course.
You know, think about these things in different ways and then come up with solutions that hopefully we can transfer in to really helping people.
Excellent. And you, implementing your ideas and getting your results, you were using C++, right? My real question is, what tool are you using in this experiment that you're now undergoing?
Well, this is a culmination of a series of things. We used a Tilera chip for our early many-core experiments.
Okay.
That's a chip with 64 cores, more now, but we had an earlier version. I built a Smalltalk virtual machine that ran on 64 cores at once.
Nice.
Well, actually, 60, but that's a mere detail. Stefan Marr, a brilliant student, came and joined that effort, and now that virtual machine is available freely on the web. It'll run on your multi-core Macintosh, you know, your 8 or 12-core Macintosh, and you can play with Smalltalk.
Excellent.
And real parallelism that way. And originally, the experiments I did were done in Smalltalk on top of this virtual machine, which was written in C++.
Okay.
And then I translated the code into C++ to get sort of better performance bounds on things.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the tools I've been using.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's great to talk to you, and thank you for taking time.
You're welcome.
You're doing some great work, and I think the creativity angle that you mentioned is a great thing.
Oh yeah, and I am just having a blast. You know, this position, the opportunity to do this work at IBM Research, it's just wonderful.
Awesome.
Thanks for interviewing me,
Chuck. Of course, man. Take care.
Take care.